Okay, thank you for inviting me to the symposium in honor of Wendell Roloffs. And so I'm going to be telling you about peptides, receptors, and pheromone biosynthesis. Most of the time is going to be spent talking about the regulation of pheromone biosynthesis. So I came to Wendell Roloff's lab in 1988 to start working on pheromone biosynthesis. And this is a classic slide that Wendell used all the time. It's computer generated now, but the original was hand-drawn slide that he used quite a few times in his lectures. Just to illustrate the whole chemical communication system with a female moth emitting a sex pheromone for attraction of the male. And at that time, almost everybody in Wendell's lab was working on this type of sex chemical communication system in moths, except for Aizhen Zhang, who was working on cockroaches. So we were doing quite a bit of work with this system from the male end and also from the female end. And that's the area that I've been working in is on the female end, specifically this end right here, which is the pheromone gland. That's where the pheromone is produced. So I'm going to first tell you a little bit about pheromone biosynthesis, and we did a lot of work with various moths over the years. The example that I'm going to be using is with heliothine moths, there are several species that are sympatric in at least the United States. We have Zea subflexum virescens. Asalta is actually from Asia. And as with most moths, there is a major component indicated by the asterisk. So Zea is Z1116 aldehyde, subflexa is Z1116 aldehyde, virescens is Z1116 aldehyde. But you can see Asalta is different. The major component is Z916 aldehyde. It does have Z1116 aldehyde as a minor component. So we actually, biosynthesis had already been worked out. We really know how Z1116 aldehyde is produced by a delta-11 desaturase, but we didn't know how the Z916 aldehyde is produced. And also in subflexa and virescence, it's interesting because there's additional pheromone components that are not aldehydes. There's an alcohol acetate ester in subflexa. In virescence, there's an alcohol. And so we were interested in how some of these other minor components are produced. We were working with subflexin virescence because of Astrid Groot and Kobe Schall made us look at those two moths because they were interested in them. But we were started doing this because of Asalta. My postdoc at the time was Man-Yun Choi, who came out of Professor Boo's lab in Korea. So he wanted to look at Asalta and see how the Z916 aldehyde is produced. And there are several ways that the Z916 aldehyde could be produced. And a general kind of biosynthetic pathway is shown here. You start with fatty acid synthesis to make 16 or 18 carbon fatty acids. These are the coenzyme A derivatives. Then you have the delta-11 desaturase, which of course Wendell had already demonstrated along with Lou Bajostad in some other moths. And of course, there's been a lot of work done now on different types of desaturases, and we're going to hear more about those later on today. But also critical to these biosynthetic pathways was chain shortening. So over here is -2 carbons, just indicating chain shortening, limited chain shortening. So you're going just from an 18 carbon to a 16 carbon in this case. So you can see that Z916 could be produced by taking 18 carbon fatty acid using a delta-11 desaturase and then chain shortening down to the 916, okay? The other way the 916 could be made is directly using 16 fatty acid as a substrate and a delta-9 desaturase to directly make the Z916. And I'm not gonna show the data, but we found that in Asalta, the moth from Korea, that they're using a delta-9 desaturase to make the Z916. That was a fast talk. So So, yeah, so the Asalta is using the Z9, delta-9 desaturase to make Z9-16. They also have a delta-11 desaturase to make the Z11-16, as does Zia and Soplexa and Virescence. But the major component of the Z9-16 in Asalta, and it's due to the delta-9 desaturase just being more active. But also we found that the Zia does not use the delta-9 desaturase to make Z9-16. It uses the delta-11 starting at 18. So even though Zia has a delta-9 desaturase, it's not functional. And this is another phenomenon that Wendell's shown over the years, that there's several desaturases can be present in pheromone glands, but maybe only one of them is really active. And that appears to be the case in Zia, that it's the delta-11 desaturase that is active. Whereas in Asalta, both the delta-9 and delta-11 desaturase are active. To make the aldehyde, you have to have a reductase, or we think this is the correct pathway to an alcohol and then an oxidase to the aldehyde. And then to the acetate ester, you start with an alcohol using an acetyl transferase. And so we want to identify these in Soplexa and Virescence to illustrate how those two moths can make those minor components through a pathway that uses a common alcohol to make both the aldehyde in the case of Soplexa and the acetate ester. And we still need to identify and chemically, biochemically, and molecularly characterize these enzymes. Okay, so that's a little bit about pheromone biosynthetic pathways. I'm now going to turn my attention to hormonal regulation. And again, this is a classic slide that Wendell used quite a bit. This is a red-banded leaf roller moth calling female. If you worked in Wendell's lab, you had to do something with red-banded leaf roller moths. So I did a lot with looking at the biosynthetic pathway and hormonal regulation. This is a calling female, so the pheromone gland is right here. She's calling. So actually with pheromone glands, it's a really neat tissue to work with because of its location, and it's exposed like that, and you can just snip it off and do extractions, chemical extractions, or you can incubate it in vitro. And probably in Wendell's lab, there have been literally millions of pheromone glands have been probably snipped off and are laying around in the lab probably still. Anyway, so to the hormonal regulation, it turns out that there's a peptide hormone that regulates pheromone biosynthesis. This was first demonstrated by Ashiel Graina, and then he identified the neuropeptide, so it's called pheromone biosynthesis activating neuropeptide. It's a neuropeptide produced in the central nervous system. It's actually produced in the subesophageal ganglia, which is right next to the brain. So we think it's released from the brain, travels through the hemolymph, and then activates the sex pheromone gland to produce pheromone. And this is illustrating how we think the pheromone gland is stimulated by PBAN. So there is a receptor, and I'll be talking more about the receptor in a little bit. This is a G protein coupled receptor. It's a typical G protein coupled receptor. There's a 7 transmembrane domains. So there's an extracellular surface, an intracellular surface. It's called G protein because it's coupled to G proteins inside the cell that transfer the signal. And in this case, we think the signal is being transferred to a calcium channel. So we demonstrated that calcium, extracellular calcium, is essential for this signal transduction cascade. So PBAN binds to the receptor, activates the receptor, in turn activates the G proteins, which causes the influx of calcium. The calcium will then further activate other enzymes in a signal transduction cascade to ultimately activate a biosynthetic pathway. Over on the right is showing helical verpazia biosynthetic pathway, which I just talked about. And we think what is one step that could be stimulated is acetyl-CoA carboxylase stimulating fatty acid synthesis. And then you just continue on to make the aldehyde. In Bombyx mori, There's also desaturase is present. It's an alcohol, though, so there's just a reductase, and Shogo Matsumoto's lab demonstrated this reductase is probably activated. Also, apparently in the silkworm moth, cyclic AMP is not involved, but cyclic AMP is involved in Helicoverpa zea. So we still need to characterize a lot of this signal transduction cascade, a lot of these enzymes. We need to identify this calcium channel, which is very important because that's one of the first steps in causing the rise in intracellular calcium. And we need to identify the PBAN receptor, which we have, and that's what I'm going to be spending the rest of my time talking about. First, I want to talk about the ligands. So this is the actual PBAN that Ashok Raina identified. Then there are several other PBAN-like molecules that have also been identified. They're all in this family of peptides based on the C-terminal sequence, which is this FSPRL amide ending. That's a 5-amino acid C-terminal ending that's critical for stimulating pheromone glands. It turns out that there's other functions for this family of peptides in not only moths but other insects. So in moths, it'll stimulate pheromone biosynthesis, cause melanization in larvae. In Bombyx morae, it has an embryonic diapause, and it turns out the diapause hormone also belongs to this family of peptides. And then more recently, it's been shown to stimulate or regulate pupil development in heliothine moths. And there's also pyrokinins. They're pyrokinins because they stimulate muscle contraction. And also in flies, they've been shown to accelerate puparium formation. So there's this pleiotropic function, various functions for this family of peptides. So they're found in all insects. This is an example of pyrokinins in various insects. Again, they're all put into this family because of the 5 C-terminal ending is very similar, and that's the minimal sequence required for activity. They're found in Drosophila. So this ETH here is the ichthyosis triggering hormone, which just has a PRL amide ending. So it's similar to the PBAN and pyrokinin family of peptides. So there's a variety of ligands found in various insects. So now we're gonna take a look at this is just illustrating where they're produced. They're produced in the central nervous system, either subesophageal ganglia or abdominal ganglia. So here's just immunocytochemistry showing a neuron producing PBAN-like peptides and releasing it into circulation through this neural hemolyte. The genes have been identified, and actually Peter Ma is going to talk more about this. But it's interesting that the diapause hormone gene, or the peptide, is encoded in the same gene as PBAN, and then there's 3 other peptides. Also notice that the diapause hormone has this sequence of FGPRL, whereas PBAN is FSPRL on the C-terminal ending. Then there's another gene called the kappa gene, also found in moths but other insects, that encodes PRV peptides, which are involved in other functions, but it also encodes a PBAN-like or a pyrokinin-like peptide, and this also has a FGPRL ending. Okay, so those are the ligands or the peptides. We want to look at the identify the receptor, and we started this using Drosophila melanogaster as a model organism, but it is an insect also. So we began by just showing, this is immunocytochemistry, showing that Drosophila has PBAN-like peptides or pyrokinin-like peptides. And then the entire genome sequence was annotated in 2000. And then in 2001, Hughes and Taggart took all of the G protein coupled receptors in Drosophila and characterized them based on similar sequences to vertebrate receptors. And they identified 4, these are just the CG numbers for the Drosophila genes. There are 4 that have sequence homology to vertebrate neuromedin-U receptor. And so that's the neuromedin-U is a receptor in vertebrates that is the most similar to the P-band receptor in insects. And then Yong-Sung Park and Mike Adams' lab actually demonstrated which of these, characterized these receptors, and found that these first two are actually a pyrokinin 2, and the 9918 is a pyrokinin 1 receptor, and then this other one that's very similar is that PRV, that other peptide coming from the kappa gene. Okay, so they characterized that in 2002. So we looked at neuromedin U. Here's the 8 amino acid sequence from pigs. It's a similar sequence, so there's an F and a P and the R. They're in the same position. We demonstrated that neuromedin U will stimulate pheromone biosynthesis, so indicating that it will bind to our receptors, so indicating the neuromedin U receptors and the P-band receptors are very similar, or most likely similar. And to make a long story short, Man-Yun Choi in my lab sequenced the P-band receptor based on sequence homology to the vertebrate neuromedin U and the Drosophila receptors. We got a full-length sequence. Then we need to show functionality, so we expressed it in SF9, insect SF9 cells. And Emily Furst in my lab developed a calcium imaging assay because we knew that calcium was involved. So there's a fluorescent calcium imaging assay that can be used. And this is illustrated here. These are all cells before the addition of ligand. When you add the ligand, the calcium is flooded inside the cell, and the assay, there's a fluorescent fluorescent compound that will bind to calcium and cause it to fluoresce, and it lights up, and you can do dose response curves and figure out which peptide then is the best one to bind to the receptor. And from that, we tested a variety of peptides. Here's P-band on the top. Here's the P-band receptor from Zia, and this is the effective concentration, 25 nanomolar for P-band. Some of these others are similar. We also did Drosophila, so the PK1 receptor, PK2 receptor. So this is PK1 in Drosophila is most effective, and PK2 then is most effective for the PK2 receptor. So this is how you can identify which ligand binds to which receptor. But you notice that P-band, there are some other peptides that will bind to the receptor also. So we wanted to know what the difference is between Drosophila and Zia, and actually how does a ligand bind to the receptor? Well, first of all, we can put these, there's a lot of sequence data that is known. We can put this into a kind of a phylogenetic tree, comparing PKN, the P-band-like receptors in moths, the PK2 and other insects, neuromedin U receptors. There's another peptide in vertebrates called ghrelin that's similar. So we can start to assemble how all these peptides are related to each other. This table I'm not going to spend much time on, but it just shows again the sequence similarity that is present. This is transmembrane 1, transmembrane 2. There's a lot of sequence similarity, and that's actually how we first identified it, because of that high sequence similarity. And there are certain motifs that are highly conserved. For example, this cysteine right here is highly conserved in all of these insects and vertebrate receptors, okay? So we tried to use this information, you know, comparing Drosophila and the P-band receptor from Zia to try to figure out what is the extracellular sequence is critical for binding the ligand. So we knew that the Drosophila one binds PK1, and then P-band binds P-band. So we wanted to make, we decided to make mutants, and we actually created chimeras. So we swapped the extracellular domain from Drosophila, in this case the extracellular domain 3 from Drosophila, and put it into the P-band receptor, okay? And then we tested to see which ligand would bind to the chimera receptor. And we found out that when we did that, we took the Drosophila extracellular domain 3 and put it into the P-band receptor. This turned out to now bind PGN24, which is actually the diapause hormone ligand, which has the FG, it's actually GLW-FGPRL ending, and also PK1, which has a similar C-terminal sequence. So we turned this P-band receptor into a PK1 receptor by exchanging that extracellular domain. So now we know that the extracellular loop 3 is somehow recognizing the difference between P-band and PK1. Okay, so now we're going to try to do further mutations and exactly figure out which part of that sequence domain is critical for binding to the ligands. We're also doing modeling. So this is the P-band receptor, 7 transmembrane domains. We know that there's a disulfide linkage between this transmembrane domain 3 and transmembrane domain 2. We did the chimeras of all of the extracellular domains. We had reduced activity with the other ones, but the extracellular 3 was kind of, as I showed, critical for binding the different types of ligands. So we're going to try to model this based on the only two GPCRs that have been crystallized. So this is rhodopsin and adrenergic receptor. They also know where the ligands for these two receptors are located. So we actually modeled this based on the rhodopsin receptor. And this is our model, our current model for the P-band receptor, showing the transmembrane domains, extracellular domains, and intracellular domains. Okay, and the ultimate, well, this is just illustrating the disulfide linkage between this transmembrane domain, and this is in yellow is the extracellular domain 2. So this disulfide is critical for activity. If you mutate that, you lose activity. So it probably, this conformation is probably correct. We don't know what the conformation of the N-terminal domain shown in blue. This is the extracellular domain 3. We really don't know that conformation. But we can start to do modeling studies. This is just a computer-generated surface structure model showing this is the N-terminal domain, extracellular domain 3. If we remove the N-terminal domain, there is an indication that there's binding pockets that are present here. So that's what we're really trying to do with looking at this modeling structure to see where we can determine where a P-band is actually binding. And our whole goal here is to try to find agonists or antagonists that will also bind to this receptor. Okay, so I'm going to end and thank these people, Ada Raffaele and Peter Stern in Israel, and also Wendell, and we'll be thanking Wendell more later tonight. Thanks.
We have a little bit of time for questions. Kobe.
Ross, have you looked at expression patterns of the receptor, of the P-band receptor, to see if it's involvement in subdevelopmental changes?
Yep, the question is, have we looked at expression patterns of the P-band receptor, and actually Ada Raffaele has done that and finds that it is upregulated in ferrate adults. So it starts actually in the pupal stage about 6 hours, I can't remember the actual numbers, but right before they emerge and then increases.
Mated females.
In mated females, P-band is still active. It's the release of P-band that's important in mated females.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Russell.
One more time. Let's talk.